Welcome to As It Is, a 30-minute program designed for English learners. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson. This program is aimed at English learners, so we speak a little slower and we use words and phrases especially written for people learning English.
We also explain words and language rules, all while bringing you stories and information from around the world. Today on the program, you will hear stories from Brian Lynn, Mario Ritter, Mernoush Karimian Ainsworth, Katie Weaver, and Christopher Jones Cruz. Dan Friedel will tell us what's trending today, and Anna Mateo will have this week's health report. But first, here is Brian Lynn.
An international human rights organization says Southeast Asia is facing increasing conflicts and violence over land grab activity. A land grab relates to taking land quickly, forcefully, and often illegally. In this case, the International Federation for Human Rights says governments need to strengthen legal reforms to protect local people from investors seeking land for business use. The call comes as the 10-member Association of Southeast Asian Nations, or ASEAN, sees significant economic growth. If ASEAN were a single country, it would be the world's seventh largest economy. The group's foreign investment reached $136.3 billion in 2014. But this economic growth has led to conflicts between local communities and investors. While businesses seek land for factories and plantations, local residents and farmers are often forced to leave their land. These evictions can lead to violence and displacement. The International Federation for Human Rights says land grabbing has displaced more than 800,000 people in Cambodia since 2000. It says the practice of land grabbing is a serious crime and has filed a case with the International Criminal Court. Many land grabs in Cambodia are related to the sugar industry. The global aid group Oxfam has urged international sugar buyers to carry out policies against land grabbing. Two of the world's largest sugar buyers are the beverage companies Coca-Cola and PepsiCo. Coca-Cola is now investigating its key sugar suppliers. PepsiCo says it has adopted a global zero-tolerance policy for land grabs. A major sugar producer is called Mitpol. The company is based in Thailand and has operations in Cambodia. In 2008, the Cambodian government granted the company access in a remote northwest province for sugar production. Rights groups said that at the time, the 200 square kilometers of land was occupied by 2,000 families. One villager told VOA that the Cambodian government forcibly evicted the entire community. When the soldiers came, I had already escaped, but I heard from a landlord later that they had burned all the houses, the villager said. The Thai Human Rights Commission said Mitpol caused the collapse of the community after taking over the land. Those allegations, along with pressure from sugar buyers, eventually led the company to leave Cambodia. The International Federation for Human Rights says land grabbing is also a big problem in Myanmar. The government has estimated that more than 800,000 hectares of land across Myanmar is considered confiscated. The country's Farmland Investigation Commission was set up in 2012 to investigate land grab cases. The new government of State Councillor Aung San Suu Kyi has set a priority of settling land disputes. Debbie Stothard is Secretary General of the IFHR. She says it will take wide-ranging reforms to Myanmar's legal system to solve the problem. I'm Brian Lin.
Voters in Tokyo have elected the city's first female governor. 64-year-old Yuriko Koike received the most votes in local elections on Sunday. Koike was elected to a 4-year term as governor of the Japanese capital, which is one of the world's largest and wealthiest cities. She will help to direct work for the 2020 Tokyo Summer Olympic Games. Preparations for the Games have suffered for a number of reasons, including overspending and delays on building projects. The first logo of the 2020 Olympics had to be redesigned following accusations of plagiarism. A Belgian designer claimed the image was like one of his creations. Yuriko Koike will be replacing Yoichi Masozoe as Tokyo's governor. He resigned after reports that he had misused public money. He was the second Tokyo governor to resign since the city won the right to host the 2020 Olympics. Koike has promised to change the city's politics. "I want to regain the trust of the people of Tokyo," she said late Sunday. Michael Kuchek is with Temple University's Institute of Contemporary Asian Studies. He spoke to VOA's Victor Beatty about the election. Kuchek says Koike's win is a sign that Tokyo voters want social change. He says women have made progress in recent years. In addition, the Japanese constitution guarantees equal rights to women. However, that has not meant that women have reached the highest levels of government and business in Japan.
But even now, the numbers of members of the Diet, members of the bureaucracy, high-level executives in corporations, particularly Japan's biggest international corporations, the levels of female managers and the levels of female participants is still astoundingly low for an industrialized country.
Koike already served as Japan's first female defense minister. She is a member of the ruling Liberal Democratic Party, or LDP. Yet she went against her party's wishes to run for the governorship of Tokyo. She defeated the LDP candidate and a candidate from the Kometo Party, which is a coalition partner with the LDP. Michael Kuchek says this could make governing difficult.
She goes in extremely difficult political situations. She defied her own party in running and thus cannot rely on the assemblymen who are LDP members or Kometo members for the other party of the coalition, and so she has no allies.
Koike promised an administration different from the ones before. "I would like, together with all of you, to run a metropolitan administration the likes of which have never been seen before," she said. Kuchek says Koike faces the possibility that costs for the Summer Olympics could rise sharply. During her campaign, she said she wanted the national government to pay more of the Olympic costs. One of Koike's first duties will be to attend the 2016 Summer Games in Rio de Janeiro. There, she is to accept the Olympic flag as the next host of the Games. I'm Mario Ritter.
Almost one-fourth of Britain's national income is earned in and around the city of London. Much of the money comes from international businesses based there. But the British vote to leave the European Union means London could lose its place as Europe's leading business center. As part of the European Union, Britain has rights to sell its services without tariffs in many countries across the continent. The EU currently has 28 member states, and it serves a market of 500 million people. But when Britain officially leaves the bloc, London-based businesses will likely lose their tax-free access to the single EU market. As a result, some banks have already said they may move their operations to the European mainland. David Slater is with the company London & Partners. Its goal is to strengthen London's image overseas and help London-based businesses work with foreign partners. Slater says the new government in Britain must negotiate for businesses to have continued access to the single market. But some European leaders say Britain cannot have special economic ties with the European Union without permitting freedom of movement. They say people from EU member states should have the right to come freely to Britain. Concern over immigration was the main issue that drove the Leave campaign to victory in Britain's Brexit vote. With the possibility that London will lose its special ties to the EU market, other cities are eyeing its position as Europe's leading financial center. The list of cities that want to replace London includes Paris, Berlin, and Amsterdam. In France, government officials recently spoke of rolling out the red carpet to businesses fleeing Brexit. They promised to make taxes for French expatriates the most favorable in Europe. The word expatriate is used to describe people who live outside their home country. In Berlin, people see a chance to expand the city's technology industry. Berlin is already Europe's second biggest tech city after London. And the prices for housing and offices are much less costly there. Lucas Kampfmann is with a business called Factory Berlin. The group is home to high-tech companies, including the music website SoundCloud. With Brexit, London has more or less taken itself out of the race, Kampfmann said. And we do believe that over time, the advantage of Berlin will grow and more tech startups will come to Berlin. Then there is Amsterdam in the Netherlands. The New York Times newspaper recently rated Amsterdam as best placed to steal London's position. The paper noted that Amsterdam has international connections, an English-speaking population, and appeal for expatriates. But London supporters still say their city will remain number one. David Slater of London & Partners says the reason is because the business people working in London want to stay there. I'm Mernoush Karimian Ainsworth.
An American skydiver has survived a 7,600-meter jump from an airplane, although he did not use a parachute. Luke Akins dropped into a huge safety net on Saturday after falling for about 2 minutes over the desert in California. Akins reached a speed of 193 kilometers per hour during the jump. He fell safely into a 30-meter by 30-meter net. Cranes held the net about 65 meters over the desert floor. Akins became the first ever skydiver to land safely without a parachute. The 42-year-old husband and father has jumped out of planes many thousands of times. But never once had he left a plane without a parachute. Akins said he was nervous before this jump. "We're talking about jumping without a parachute," he told reporters. "I take that very seriously. It's not a joke." Akins prepared for 2 years to make the jump. Three skydivers with parachutes made the jump with him. They video recorded the event and carried equipment Akins needed, like an oxygen mask. He removed the mask after falling about 2,100 meters. Akins rolled in the air just moments before he hit the net, so as to land on his back. The net stretched deeply. The skydiver did not move for several seconds as the net was lowered to the ground. Then Akins stood, waved his arms, and hugged his wife. I'm Katie Weaver.
Honeybees are in danger worldwide. Their homes, known as colonies, are suffering from what scientists call colony collapse disorder. Scientists have linked the disorder to infections from harmful microorganisms and pesticides, products meant to kill other insects. Researchers also have blamed a sharp drop in the honeybee population to loss of the bee's natural habitat. Polish researchers are working on ways to save honeybees. One of the diseases that affect honeybee colonies in Poland is nosmosis, also called nosema. It is a common fungi-based disease that affects adult bees. Aneta Potasnieskaya is a researcher with Maria Curie Słodowska University.
Infected worker bees live for a very short time in the summer, about 8 to 12 days, while they normally live 36 days. So the productivity of the whole bee family decreases, and bees also have problems with passing the winter.
Scientists believe some pesticides weaken the bees' natural resistance against disease. This makes it difficult for them to fight parasitic organisms. After eating food or drinking water containing pesticides, the bees begin to act strangely and soon die. Scientists believe Nosema is one of the main reasons the number of bees dropped by 50% in Poland over the past 15 years. Polish scientists say they have found a natural substance in flowers that is more than 90% effective in saving bees. They have created a drug from it. The drug is now being tested. Scientists are warning that insecticides designed to kill mosquitoes carrying the Zika virus can also harm bees. They say such products should be used in affected areas only when it is dark, after bees are asleep. And they say only chemicals that kill the mosquito larvae should be used. Michael Steinkampf is a beekeeper.
This particular strain is very toxic to mosquito larvae, but when it's put in the water, it doesn't hurt the bees at all.
I'm Christopher Jones Cruz.
This is what's trending today. A rare flower called the Titan arum is about to blossom at the U.S. Botanic Garden. Unlike most flowers, though, it is very smelly. Some people say the smell is like rotting flesh or a dead body. That is why the flower is sometimes called a corpse flower. Corpse is a term for a dead body. The flower comes from Indonesia, where the tropical climate is warm most of the time. Washington, D.C. is warm in the summer, but it is too cold for the plant to survive outside during the winter. So the plant lives indoors in a greenhouse, where the temperature can be controlled and it is warm and humid year-round. The plant does not produce flowers each year. Once it blossoms, it may not bloom again for a number of years. The flower is actually a collection of hundreds of small flowers working together. The Titan arum produces its strong smell to attract insects. The insects help pollinate the flower and make sure the Titan arum can produce the next generation. The bad smell only lasts about 2 days. After that, the plant goes dormant again. The U.S. Botanic Garden has shown 5 other Titan arums since 2003. This is the first time this 6-year-old plant has blossomed, and people are excited. The garden is open to visitors longer than usual each day so people can see the flower. It is supposed to be smelliest at night. There is also a live webcam so people can check the status of the plant. Last week, the same kind of plant bloomed at a garden in New York City. Many people posted videos and photos on Facebook and Twitter. The one in New York opened on Friday. By Monday, it was not smelly anymore. And that's what's trending today. I'm Dan Friedel.
From VOA Learning English, this is the Health and Lifestyle Report. Getting a good night's sleep tonight could guard children against weight gain in the future. According to a new study, putting preschoolers in bed by 8 p.m. could reduce their chances of becoming overweight or obese later in life by half. Preschoolers are children around the age of 4 or 5. The term obese refers to calculations of your body mass index, what doctors call BMI. They use a person's height, weight, and age to assess their amount of body fat. BMIs help tell whether a person is underweight, normal, overweight, or obese. The World Health Organization says obesity can lead to serious long-term health problems like diabetes, heart disease, and stroke. Researchers from The Ohio State University's College of Public Health have found that young children who go to bed after 9 p.m. are twice as likely to be obese later in life. The researchers wrote their findings in the Journal of Pediatrics. The lead author of the study is Sarah Anderson. She is an associate professor of epidemiology. She studies how diseases spread and how they can be controlled. Anderson says that for parents, the results of the study support the importance of creating a bedtime routine. She says that having a usual bedtime routine is something families can do to lower their child's risk of becoming overweight. A usual early bedtime, Anderson adds, is also likely to have positive benefits on behavior and on social, emotional, and cognitive development. Researchers used data from 977 children for the study. These children are part of a larger project called the Study of Early Child Care and Youth Development. The project follows healthy babies born in 1991 in 10 U.S. cities. The children were 4.5 years old when their mothers reported their usual weekday bedtime. Researchers then divided the children into 3 groups. Those who went to bed by 8 p.m. or earlier, those who went to bed between 8 p.m. and 9 p.m., and those whose bedtimes were after 9 p.m. When these children turned 15 years old, the researchers looked at their rates of obesity. Of those with the earliest bedtimes, only 1 out of 10 was obese. Of those who went to bed between 8 and 9 p.m., 16% became obese. And out of those with the latest bedtimes, 23% became obese. Anderson said putting children in bed early does not mean they will immediately fall asleep. But she adds it makes it more likely that children will get the amount of sleep they need to be at their best. But Anderson says it is important to understand that having early bedtimes may be harder for some families than others. She says that families have many competing demands and there are trade-offs that get made. For example, she says, if some parents work late, that can push the children's bedtimes to later in the evening. Obesity among children in the United States is a major health concern. About 17% of children and teenagers in the U.S. are considered obese. That is according to the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. The World Health Organization reported in 2014 that the number of overweight babies and young children worldwide had increased from 31 million in 1990 to 44 million in 2012. If that trend continues, the WHO warns, there will be 70 million obese children in the world by 2025. I'm Ana Mateo.
And that's our program for today. Listen again tomorrow to learn English through stories from around the world. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson.